You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
So hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. Welcome. I'm Sarah Resnick, and I'm one of the editors of Triple Canopy, and I'm going to be moderating this evening. Tonight's conversation will center on the nexus between Trump's far-reaching deportation policy and what is commonly called broken windows policing or zero tolerance policing here in New York City. Or to put it another way, we'll be talking about immigration policy at the federal level and policing policy at the city level. So in the wake of Trump's January 25th executive order, Mayor de Blasio promised to protect immigrants and to uphold New York status as a sanctuary city. Police Commissioner James O'Neill, for instance, said that the NYPD will not cooperate with these orders. But while these statements are, I suppose, narrowly true, our local policing strategy is at odds with the city's commitment. And so this evening we'll be speaking about why this is the case and perhaps what we can do to better protect the non-citizens among us. So to help us with this conversation, we have Luba Cortez and Jessica Swenson. Luba is a youth organizer at Make the Road New York, which is one of the city's largest immigrant rights organizations. At Make the Road, Luba helps advocate for policy change and build youth leadership through immigrant experiences. And Jessica is a supervising attorney in the immigration practice at the Bronx Defenders, which is an organization that provides legal support to indigent Bronx residents. And she defends clients in removal proceedings, among many other things. And I'd like to thank them both so much for being here, because no doubt you guys have been pretty busy in the last few weeks, and it's really generous of you to take your time to come and talk to us here. So as the evening progresses, we're gonna talk more about their work and their respective organizations. And I just wanted to quickly sort of introduce the context for this talk. So we're sort of hoping this will be perhaps one of many conversations at Triple Canopy devoted to Trump's policies and how they interact with those here in our city. Because of course, as many federal policies do and will have a place-based dimension, and as residents of New York, they will impact us in a particular way. I guess, but also because New York, as with cities across the country, can be a kind of activist in its own right. Cities do have a lot of agency, both political and financial, and can do a lot to support common goods like fair wages and climate action, creative culture, rights for LGBTQ folks, and for immigrants. So as with tonight's program, in the coming months, Triple Canopy will be looking to local organizations and to individuals who have long been involved with struggles directly affected by Trump's policies to help guide us toward practical actions we might take in the coming months and years, actions that can help facilitate their work and bolster their efforts. So to start, I'm going to ask Jessica and Luba to describe their respective organizations. Then we're going to move through a kind of summary and discussion of the events of the last few weeks, probably define some terms, and then talk about potential responses. And then sort of toward the end, we'll open up the conversation to everyone here to participate. And there's probably one or two people in the audience I will call on to respond because of work I know that they are doing. But I'd like to encourage everyone to get involved. So I'm not sure, actually. Jessica, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Hello. Okay. So Like Sarah said, I'm a supervising attorney in the immigration practice at the Bronx Defenders. We're a public defender in the Bronx, as you might guess from the name. And so we have a criminal defense practice, family, immigration, and civil. We have a holistic model, which means that as soon as a client is arrested, we recognize that any number of consequences can precipitate from that, and we try to represent our clients as people and address and triage needs as they see them. And our immigration practice specifically has grown over the past 3 years from about 6 people to over 20 people. And we do removal defense, which means representing people facing deportation. And we also advise on criminal consequences, immigration consequences of criminal contacts for all of our non-citizen clients.
Hey. So I work at Make the Road New York. I'm a youth organizer. And the focus of my work is to do social justice and to talk about it with an intersectional lens. So I do a lot of political education with young people, meaning we talk about transphobia, homophobia, racism, and empower them through their immigrant narratives. A lot of them are undocumented. But Make the Road as a whole works with the immigrant community. So we have Black, Brown membership that comes to our org to empower themselves. We also offer survival services like legal support, health care if they need it, access to it, wage theft campaigns and things like that. So it's really important for us to do this work because we know that the core of empowering our communities is to teach them the way to defeat the system that continuously oppresses them. So the heart of Make the Road is to do that. And we have over 18,000 members that come to all of our offices, which are in Manhattan, in Queens, Long Island, and Brooklyn.
Okay, great. I'm sure by now everyone in this room is fairly familiar with Trump's executive order of January 25th, but I figured we might start with the basics and just sort of review some of the details because I think it can be a bit confusing. I don't know, Jessica, maybe we can start with you. What does the order actually say with respect to immigrants and non-citizens living in the states? Who exactly and who do these policies impact?
Yeah, so there were two different orders, actually, that were both issued on January 25th, and one addressed public safety in the interior, and the other addressed border security. And they're both pretty radical departures from what was happening under Obama, which maybe we'll get into later, which wasn't a really sunny picture for our non-citizens, but it's still a pretty radical negative departure. And so the interior, I guess I'll just talk about them both generally. It doesn't really matter which is which. So the main thing that we saw, especially for the clients that I work with in our community in the Bronx, is that basically everyone who is undocumented is now a priority for deportation. Under Obama's policy, there were sort of different levels of who was a priority. If you were already subject to being deported, that's either based on lack of status, or if you have status but have certain criminal convictions and you're subject to being deported. His administration was only targeting certain groups of those people and, in theory, not going after other people. In practice, people were getting swept up anyway. Now, under these Trump orders, he's just saying anyone undocumented is going to be targeted. The sort of scary part for a lot of our clients is he's saying that specifically people with criminal convictions and any criminal conviction, no matter how small, and people even with pending criminal charges are going to be targeted. And that's problematic on a lot of levels. We have a presumption of innocence in this country, and so we don't want to be going after people who are wrongfully accused. It also has a problem if someone were to be deported with an open criminal case, then they'd have a warrant out for their arrest should they ever try to come back. So those are just some sort of practical concerns. It also highlights anyone with any sort of fraud in their immigration history, and some people might think if someone committed fraud, maybe they should be a priority. In the context of immigration in general, fraud is pervasive, and it is rarely on the particular person who's filing an immigration application that might have fraud on it. Immigration law is incredibly intricate. People seek out attorneys, people seek out notarios who are not attorneys, and other people who have filed applications for them that might not have all the correct information, and then it might be these non-citizens who end up being targeted due to no fault of their own. I'm just looking at my notes. So the other things in the memos are that Trump is trying to really reinforce the links between federal immigration enforcement and local law enforcement. There's agreements that the federal administrations have entered into with local law enforcement for years and years. It's been up to the local law enforcement agency whether they want to sign on to these or not. The federal government provides them incentives to do so, and they're basically deputized to act as immigration officials, which is very scary for our communities. We want our non-citizens to be able to go to the police to report crimes, to trust in them, and how are they going to do that if these people are also deputized to act as immigration enforcement? The big term that's been thrown around all over the place is a sanctuary city, and Trump has tried to vilify that term. And so he's saying that sanctuary cities are gonna be defunded, meaning that if a city is calling itself a sanctuary city, if it's providing protection to non-citizen people in any way, he doesn't define anything, he just sort of throws that out there, that they won't receive federal funding anymore. Whether, the extent to which he's actually able to do that is completely unknown. It will definitely face legal challenges, but it's just something that, it's meant to instill fear in the communities. And another big thing that the memo says is an increase in expedited removal. That means people can be deported without seeing an immigration judge. He wants to expand the group of people that applies to. And just an incredible increase in the number of agents, if border agents, of enforcement, which obviously has to be earmarked by Congress, but if it happens, then that could show an incredible increase in enforcement too and really clog our systems that are already overburdened with the number of people that our country's trying to deport. The final thing is, I don't know if people have heard of secure communities in the room, which was a former policy that I believe Bush started and continued for a little bit under Obama, and then Obama got rid of it. What it does is when someone's arrested, you're fingerprinted, your fingerprints get shared with the FBI. That's a normal sort of vertical thing that happens. Then the FBI shares those fingerprints with the Department of Homeland Security, and under secure communities, Department of Homeland Security would use those fingerprints to search to see if they had a match in their system for that person. If that person was out of status, if they had a green card but had convictions that made them subject to deportation, then they would do what's called dropping a detainer. They would ask whatever law enforcement custody that person is in to hold that person so that ICE could come and pick them up. And that was happening everywhere, and it was terrifying because people were being arrested. There's racial profiling, people being arrested for false pretenses, and then they're just getting swept up into the immigration dragnet. Obama put an end to that after a lot of organizing happened, a lot of vocal opposition, a lot of lawsuits filed. He replaced it with something called the Priority Enforcement Memo. It didn't change a whole lot. He changed the detainer into a request for notification. In practice, it didn't change a whole lot, but now Trump is bringing back secure communities. He wants to make it even stronger. He wants to sweep people up. I think maybe we're getting into this a little bit later, but we have, in New York City, we have certain protections already to try to evade the havoc of secure communities.
Did you want to add anything?
The first three executive orders that came out under President Trump were a clear attack on immigrants, and I want to make sure that folks understand that. And also that this system that is happening was directly inherited from Obama. Obama is the president that deported most people than any other president in the history of the U.S. So Donald Trump did not just come out with this anti-immigrant narrative by himself. It already existed in the Obama administration. things like 287G, which is local law enforcement working with immigration, existed under Obama. So all of these things have been combated by organizations from before. And it's just more palpable now, more clear that there is hate and attack on immigrant communities. But I think you covered a lot of the basic things that we were talking about.
Well, actually, so Luba, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what's happened within immigrant communities in the last weeks as a result.
There's a lot of fear that exists within the immigrant communities, but there's also been a lot of resilience, which is really beautiful because we know that this, again, is an attack on us, especially on Black and Brown communities. So what immigrants have been doing across New York and across the country is uniting and understanding the power that comes from their narratives. And something that came up has been that people have been scared to share who they are, say that they're undocumented. After the first executive order came out, many people didn't go to school, people stopped going to work because they felt that they were going to be targeted. And so what organizations have doing is teaching folks their rights, so telling them, this is what you need to know if ICE comes to your home, do not open the door, do not sign anything, because it's the most basic thing that makes them feel safe. And I think it's really important to understand that when we're talking about how to support the immigrant community. But that's some of the things that we've been doing. Also, having folks organize. And organizing can be something so simple as opening your home to undocumented people, right? Like we talk about sanctuary spaces, but in reality, that doesn't mean anything because ICE can go inside of a school, ICE can go inside of a church. There's no moral crisis anymore. And I think before we were trying to tap into their sense of like, oh, we're all humans, right? But that doesn't work because they're here targeting us, they're here to criminalize us, to kidnap us, to deport us. And it's been really tragic, the result of this, especially on mental health. We had a case where someone was deported to Mexico and killed themselves, right, immediately after they got to Mexico. We had documented youth. I don't know if folks are familiar with deferred action for childhood arrival, but we had 8 young people in Chicago kill themselves, right? So this is the responses also that are happening from the community, which is fear, which is not having their problems heard because they're so scared to access mental health services because they're also not able to get them because they're undocumented. So those are the things that have been happening, but I do want to highlight that we survived genocide, we've survived violence before, and we're going to be able to survive 4 years of Trump, right, because we've done it in the past.
Okay, so you brought up you both have brought up the term sanctuary. And in the last, in the wake of the order, de Blasio came out and sort of reaffirmed New York's commitment to being a sanctuary city. But what is that, so how are we to understand that term and what does it actually mean? Does it have any legal status?
No.
Okay.
That was the easy part. It doesn't have a legal status. I think when de Blasio talks about it, what he means is specific protections that New York City has put in place for the non-citizen communities. And like they shouldn't be sort of undervalued. They're wonderful, but they have to be viewed in the context of what else the city is doing and what law enforcement is doing in our communities as well. So what the protections are is that for a very long time, the NYPD has had a memo of understanding, or I'm sorry, just a policy memo that they don't ask people their status and they're not directly participating in these 287G agreements. That's been in existence for a long time. A more sort of recent development that has had a couple of iterations and now is in its strongest form is we have a New York City detainer law. So how I was talking before about the secure communities detainers, New York City has basically said at this point that we are almost never going to honor these detainers. There are certain exceptions, but without getting into the nitty-gritty details, it's basically that you need to get a warrant from a federal judge and your client needs to have a serious conviction in conjunction with that. And since that has passed, we've seen almost no detainers honored. So our clients are no longer being turned over from criminal custody into the hands of ICE. And that's been huge, and I've seen that in a huge change in the people that we represent in removal proceedings as a result. The flip side of that is that ICE is going other places to find people. They're not getting them directly from jail. They're going into their homes at 6 a.m, knocking down the door and, you know, and going in, snatching people in front of their families and taking them into custody. So they're finding workarounds to this system. And the, I guess just a final thing is that New York City has universal representation for people who are detained and in removal proceedings. It's something that my office participates in, which means that if you can't afford a lawyer, then you, and you're detained, then you get a free lawyer. So those are sort of the things that make New York City a sanctuary city. But, you know, broken windows policing is something that really detracts from any sort of stance that we are 100% a sanctuary.
Okay, I just wanted to follow up quickly on the universal representation. So my understanding is that in the rest of the country, if you are detained, you do not have the right to legal defense. Is that correct?
That's mainly correct. So okay. New York City was the first city to provide this. It's funded by the city council still right now. And LA is getting their program up and running, and there's a couple of other smaller programs that are starting to follow, which is really exciting.
Okay, so de Blasio is saying, well, we're a sanctuary city. You know, no one's going to get arrested for jumping a turnstile. The NYPD commissioner is sort of saying the same thing, but maybe there's a contradiction in terms of our policing strategy, which is commonly referred to as broken windows. And so maybe we can talk about what that means. Luba, do you want to?
Yeah, so I think when we're speaking about immigration, sometimes we get lost in the narrative of the good immigrant versus the bad immigrant. And so is the good immigrants the ones that go to school, they came here when they were very little, they deserve to not be deported, but the criminals, they deserve to go. And I think that that's very important to discuss because we don't want to criminalize anybody, right? Like no one deserves to be deported and we don't want to get lost in the morality of who should be deported versus who should not be deported. And I think that's very important to highlight because folks often don't talk about it. And yes, so New York City comes out as looking progressive all the time, but the reality is that it's not. In Staten Island, we had ICE break into a home and pull out a gun on somebody. So these things happen in New York City. I mean, we have one of the, it's called like worse than Guantanamo Bay right here in Manhattan, right? So we know that there's like, NYPD is like the second largest army in the US. So there's like always, the threat of violence by these systems, and ICE and police are one and the same, and they continuously threaten our communities. So de Blasio, right, continues talking about sanctuary spaces, but I don't believe in that because they continue to put more enforcement and more black and brown bodies are being put into jail and are being deported. So I think it's important that we like fight back against those systems and that we are able to change the narrative and the context of the conversations that are happening. And so with that being said, I think that it's important the work that you do as legal support, and it's important to continue organizing and getting our folks to know how to stop these systems.
Do you want to add anything to that? I mean,
sure, no, okay. I mean, that was like what I would have said too. Broken windows policing is basically just, you know, it's targeting people for quote unquote quality of life crimes. So it's really low level offenses. And the way that it's implemented is by having police inundate mostly poor communities of color and arresting people for turnstile jumping, for marijuana possession, for petty larceny, which is like very low-level thefts. And it's things that the theory behind broken windows policing is that if none of these crimes are happening, that in general it creates like a safer community, a community where people want to live. That's been proven over and over again not to be the case. What it does is it instills fear in the community and it sweeps people up into the criminal justice system, which is really hard to break out of.
Okay, and so you talked earlier about secure communities and about the how whenever anyone is arrested, their ICE has access to their fingerprints. So you can be, say, arrested for jumping a turnstile, and the next thing you know, ICE is knocking at your door. Is that sort of?
Yeah, so
accurate,
yeah, it is. Okay. And so, I mean, even without secure communities, because secure communities basically just allows the Department of Homeland Security, like ICE, to drop these detainers and ask local law enforcement to hold people until ICE can come and pick them up. But even before that, like, federal agencies can share information with each other. And when you get arrested, your fingerprints go to the FBI and then they can be shared with another federal agency. So with or without secure communities, ICE can find out about you if you get arrested. And so even if people aren't being held by Department of Corrections or by NYPD, ICE can find out about you, and then if they want to, they can find you if they have your address, if you, for example, came in on a visa, like a visitor visa, and you never left. They can look up your last known address, or they can maybe get it from the criminal court system, and that's how we're seeing an increase in home raids, like Luba mentioned also. And so that's how these low-level arrests are sort of leading to ICE coming and finding people.
Okay, so maybe now we can sort of move into what some possible responses might be. So, like, what are the kinds of things that New York, maybe even at the city or at the state level, can be doing to help right now? Luba, do you want to respond first?
I want to add something to the last thing you said. So you don't have to be arrested in order for immigration to have your info. Anytime that you've applied for any sort of adjustment of status, they will have your info. If you traveled outside of the country and came back, they will have your info. If you apply for deferred action, which is something common that we've seen, we've told folks that they shouldn't renew if they move their address because we don't want them to have their information. So if you go to the DMV, they have your information. If you've had contact with anything that has to do with the government, they have your information. There was a lot of panic with the NYC ID that de Blasio came out, that folks were scared that immigration was going to have access to that. But de Blasio said he would delete it, and then he got like a FOIL, and now they haven't been able to delete that info. But that will not, immigration won't have access to that. So I know that's a question that a lot of folks have. So that is safe, but in other aspects, immigration can have access to your info at any moment. And we also know there's like surveillance and things that they do to undocumented communities. But to the question that you asked, yeah, so one of the main things is, again, the Know Your Rights training. So hosting trainings in your local communities, in your homes, so that folks are aware of the things that they can do. I mean, there's so many nuances and things that occur within the system, but it's important for them to know. We also encourage folks to hold pressure on Cuomo and on de Blasio to uphold the narrative of saying that this is going to be a sanctuary space and not allow, right, like local law enforcement to work with ICE. I mean, I know that there's a detainer law, but things like that happen. And also to look outside of New York City, because if we look at Long Island, I mean, it's one of the most racially segregated places. I used to live in Long Island, and I have family that's undocumented that lives there. And the things that they tell me and their experiences are terrible. I mean, the KKK was recruiting in Long Island a couple of months ago. So, I mean, people get lost in New York as like this hub of culture and coolness. But outside of New York City, I mean, it's racism and xenophobia that's there. So I think it's important to organize in places that don't have access. Like if we look at the border towns, right? Trump's executive order is going to militarize the border even more. But those communities don't have access to organizations like here in New York City. So offering support to organizations, I mean, to places that are in the border is crucial. And yeah, holding pressure to your local politicians and things like that is really important, making calls, lobbying. But to me, the most important is just getting the community informed and getting them ready. And so we've seen this right after Trump won the presidency, we got 15,000 people to come out on the streets in March, right? We saw the Women's March that happened. So we've seen a response of people getting ready to fight back, and people are taking the streets, even if they're undocumented, they're not scared, right? Because they wanna go out and they wanna support. So I think I wanna encourage that. But also if you feel safe and able to do so.
Do you feel like your job has changed a lot in the last couple months?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's unfortunate because My youth are scared. I work with young people, and they sometimes come crying to the office. One of our core young people, whose name is Perla, who I love dearly, she's a Mexican youth, just had immigration go to her house, and she was trained in a Know Your Rights training, right? She knows you're not supposed to open the door if ICE gets there, but she opened the door because she panicked, right? Because I said, we're going to break down the door, and because her dad is undocumented and he was home, she was like, I'm gonna open this door because I don't want him to come in here. And luckily no one was detained, but this shows, right, that they're here, they're in our doors, they're in our spaces, and that we really need to be able to show community. So if you open your home to someone who's scared because they know that ICE is gonna go to their home, like, that's solidarity, right? If you're a lawyer and can offer free services to someone that might be detained, like, that's solidarity. And so my job has changed because now I'm always on response mode, like getting calls. We have an email thread that's called Redadas or Raids. So whenever there's a raid, people will send info and someone has to go and check it out. And I also think there's a panic mode. So folks are panicked and information is spreading. So someone will go outside right now and say there's ICE there, right? And then people are reposting it on Twitter, on Facebook, and it's like wildfire and people are scared, but in reality it's just police during like routine checkups. So we know that we also want to make sure that the information we're sharing is true and that we're not just spreading panic. So confirming that, yes, this is ICE, taking a picture, recording what's happening and confirming is important, and not spreading fear, because I work in Jackson Heights and in one day the streets were empty. And Jackson Heights is one of the most beautiful and vivid communities that exists in New York City. And it was empty because they were saying that there was ICE on the 7 line. And there was no ICE presence. So also being accountable and showing that we do have a responsibility to the people that we work with and the people that are friends and part of our community.
So do you want to add anything?
Yeah. So I just wanted to echo what Luba said about like continuing to like take to the streets and continue being angry. It really goes a long way. And also to not spread fear unnecessarily. I mentioned before when I was sort of going through the different parts of the executive orders that anyone with a pending criminal charge is now a priority. You have to be subject to deportation to be a priority for deportation. So if someone just has a green card and they have a pending criminal case, they're not subject to deportation. But when this memo came out, it was terrifying, and people all of a sudden are like, can I be deported? I am here in lawful status. I was arrested. And the answer is no. And so a lot of what, you know, this sort of goes to the other question too, has my job changed? Yeah, it's an increase in people who actually aren't at risk and telling them that you are okay. And that's been really, really disheartening. And then I guess just the counterpoint of that is that a lot of my work hasn't changed. Just like we both said, you know, we were representing people in deportation proceedings under Obama, the highest number of deportations in the history of our country. So it's sort of just like keeping along, doing what we're doing, and then responding to crises in the community and trying to get the truth out there while dispelling all the bad information.
So maybe this is a good time to open it up to others in the audience. Does anyone have a question?
In terms of like maybe how you're advising some people that you're encountering that are here under DACA and may not have criminal records, but are incredibly fearful because they may be very active in their communities, they may be speaking out for their communities, but are now potentially afraid to, you know, what, if at all, any kind of security they have in as this kind of status under Obama, but now it seems unclear whether they are now going to be targeted.
So under Deferred Action, the program, it essentially says that anyone that has it is kind of exempt from being deported unless they commit a crime. And what we saw, there's been a few cases. So Daniel, who was home and then ICE came to his house and he was detained, is currently in a detention center, had no criminal record, had DACA. Daniela, who is one of the most famous cases right now, was an activist, was speaking at a press conference, was sharing her narrative, saying that her brother and her dad were both targeted by ICE. And a few hours after she spoke at the press conference, she was detained and she was released from a detention center, I believe, 2 or 3 days ago. So that sparked a conversation on whether people that have DACA are safe. Under this administration, we don't know. I mean, everything that's been happening, it's so volatile that we don't know what's going to happen, honestly. There's no security for activism or organizing. I mean, we know that sometimes the government equates organizing as terrorism, right? And so if you are willing to do this work, those are the risks that are attached to it. I know that a lot of organizations are being surveilled, especially Muslim organizations like DRUM have definitely been infiltrated before. We know that there's chances that like we could be surveilled, so that's just the reality of the work. Unfortunately, I can't say that people that have deferred action are safe. But I think that there is a beauty in coming out and saying, I'm undocumented, I'm not scared. And I remember the first time that I shared my story and I said I'm undocumented and how I felt and how I was ready to get other young people to say it also. And it's kind of like coming out, right, as powerful as a being and not being hidden anymore. And I think there's a beauty in that, but definitely there are risks. And if you're afraid, I think it's valid and you should not share your story if you think that you are gonna be targeted. But I always wanna encourage to challenge ourselves in that. But right now, I definitely don't wanna see more of our people deported. We don't wanna see more of our people incarcerated. So for folks that have questions about that, I think I'm definitely down to sit down with them and talk and see what feels safe for them. Maybe like the way to advocate is not to go out to a protest, but maybe do something on social media. I think also we always think about romanticizing what the movement is and like always being on the streets or being in TV and all that, but that's not what it is, right? Like just sharing information with someone is organizing. Just helping them fill out paperwork is organizing. So I think that there's different ways to support the movement that don't necessarily mean that you have to be out on the streets.
Yeah, and I'll just add from like our like a law office or like what our legal team is advising people, which is that since DACA is up in the air, we are advising in general people who are DACA eligible, but who have never applied for DACA before. We're advising really conservatively that, you know, this is still technically something that exists, this program, if you've never applied for it before. Just keep in mind that what you're doing is you are taking a stand and you're saying, like, I'm undocumented, you're coming out of the shadow. And unfortunately, part of that is filling out an application that you're filing with the federal government. And so most people hearing that have opted not to apply for DACA as first-time applicants. But we are still doing renewal applications until the day that they officially discontinue it, and maybe it'll never come. We're still doing renewal applications for people.
Abu, did you want to say something perhaps about the new sanctuary movement? This is Abu Farman.
Do you want to sit on the couch?
I'll sit down here. I'll sit down here. We're so polite here. So I'm Abu. Thank you for all of that information. I'll have a couple of things to say. I mean, I have a million things to say, but I'll say a couple. I have a stronger inclination towards sanctuary than most people and its powers. I work with the New Sanctuary Coalition in New York City. It was one of the first who started this whole sanctuary movement in 2000. Well, it starts in the 80s. We'll skip that history, but in 2009. De Blasio didn't invent sanctuary. It comes out of actual activism, work that immigrant undocumented people, along with faith-based coalitions, did to renew a movement that had started in the 80s. And the premises of that movement became what sanctuary cities took off on, right? Which is basically actually quite powerful when you think about it and think there's a possibility to say there's a space for conscience and there's space for sovereignty where you can say, your law is not my law. Where, of course, in reality, when you intersect with the state, things go to hell. But to be able to say that is a commitment. And it's not just symbolic. I think it means that people are going to commit to something real. And so in that sense, I mean, both in terms of, I mean, conscience sounds like a namby-pamby kind of word, but it's, you know, I think of Hannah Arendt writing about totalitarianism, where she says totalitarianism is where there's no possibility of a conscience anymore, right? So it, when you think of it that way, it's not so namby-pamby. And the idea of sovereignty may be too ambitious, but there's also something about being able to put that wedge between sort of larger mandates of law enforcement and more local ones. So there's something interesting there that I think is worth kind of defending. It's not, the other thing maybe is to understand that it's obviously not going to be foolproof, but the fear that the anti-sanctuary rhetoric of Trump administration has brought about is not just a fear only in the undocumented immigrant populations. It's also amongst the allies who are backing away from that term, from adopting, who are not standing up. Right? People are not standing up, and that's also a fear that's relevant, I think, in the discussion. People do need to kind of stand up. And you know, that also goes to the point you made about activism, which is, on some level, nobody facing this administration is fully properly documented. You know, if documentation, in a sense, is about the level of kind of rights and protection that you have facing the state, nobody who's going to speak out is properly documented. I mean, not to take away from the vulnerabilities of different kinds of populations, but I think, you know, it's a way of also implicating everybody else, people here who are citizens, who are not racially marked and so on. There's a lot of ways with broken windows policing that immigrants get trapped, and there's like 170 crimes that are not subject to the sanctuary city policies as well, right? Is that, that's...
For the detainer?
For the 27G, yeah. Right? Yeah. So it's not like it's, oh, in no case will we not share information. It's like there's a big, 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 big gamut. But nevertheless, I think it's kind of... The other thing I just want to say is that, you know, this history is also... It's not just Obama. We sort of, our memory goes back to Obama. But really, ICE and DHS were... They did not exist before Bush. This is post 9/11 stuff, right? This is Bush started DHS. It was INS before, and the whole idea of sort of detaining people, immigrants on criminal charges and deporting them, is actually a Clinton thing from 1996 immigration, right? So these histories kind of matter also when we assess what we're facing. ICE has a couple of $1 billion to spend just on detaining people. So this is not, you know, it's about mass deportation, it's about mass detention, it's the same sort of carceral system that's putting, you know, 2 million mostly black and Latino people in jail. And it's not just about the jails, it's also about all the judicial system that's around it. You know, maybe there's, 2 million people in jail, there's 4 million people who are interfacing with the whole carceral system. Same thing with immigration. You get 34,000 people in detention beds, but you got 400,000 people actually interacting with the immigration criminal system throughout the year. The weird thing about the immigration system is ICE itself. It's such a strange entity, and you know, it has to be more and more emphasized how much they break the law all the time, how much they get around constitutional rights without any kind of accountability. I mean, they're the ones who are acting criminally in the end, right? And judging others on criminality.
So you're working with the New Sanctuary Movement, and so what are some of the strategies or programs that you're trying to implement right now?
So a lot of it is what, you know, I mean, a lot of groups in the city and across the nation are doing, you know, amazing work as activists. And so the New Sanctuary Coalition does a lot of that stuff. They're also, a lot of the activists are strong undocumented, within the New Sanctuary Coalition, strong undocumented workers themselves, who, for example, very recently made Union City, New Jersey, a sanctuary city through their own activism, where the mayor came out and started issuing NYC ID type cards and telling the police not to, you know. So there's a lot of that kind of organizing and activism, and there's a push that, you know, may not seem significant to some people, but I think is significant, is to spread sanctuary spaces. People who are claiming that term and the commitment that it brings with it to more than just the faith-based communities or the faith-based spaces that say we're a sanctuary church, which means they're ready to take somebody who's slated for deportation and keep them there and protect them there so that ICE doesn't come in. Now, ICE has an internal memo that says we're not going to go into school. It's not law or anything, but it's just an internal memo. Don't go into schools. Don't go into churches.
That resonated. I think just to talk about the 34,000 beds, I don't know if a lot of folks know, but there's something called the bed mandate. That ICE has quotas the same way the police have quotas. They just don't talk about it. So each day, 34,000 beds have to be filled in detention centers, which means that ICE has to figure out a way how to get all those people, and that's how we get them going inside homes, going outside of courthouses, trying to detain people. And this is really important to know because it goes to capitalism and the need to have black and brown bodies detained, incarcerated. And also that there is like labor that they force these folks to do. But because it's not in prisons, it's different and it's allowed. And also the inhumane conditions that exist within detention centers, that there's pictures on the internet, but unless you've been there, there's no way to be able to talk about those things. And there's been cases where a woman gave birth shackled to a bed. Right, so there's these things that are happening. And then the other thing that you mentioned is about how folks are constantly in this system of either getting arrested or being detained. I also want to highlight how the queer and trans community is being affected by all of this, especially there was a trans woman who was seeking support from her abuser. She went to a court and denounced him. And then she was detained by ICE. So who are you gonna call if you're being hurt, you're being harmed, but police and ICE are one and the same? So who's keeping us safe if the people that are supposed to keep us safe are incarcerating us and not helping us, right? So I think that's very important to highlight. And yes, going back into Bush and Islamophobia that has come out, the third executive order was a clear statement against the Muslim community. And in reality, no one is safe, right? Like, residents are not safe because residents were deported to places that they don't call home. So nobody is really safe. And yes, the activism is really important. I think that we need to continue to push making New York a sanctuary space, but also being real about what that means, because like Cuomo has said that if Trump defunds sanctuary cities, that he will still support and give money to the communities. But there are certain programs, like health programs, that would be affected if Trump were to defund it and wouldn't be able to get funds to it. So it would mean like a lot of pressure, a lot of organizing, and continue to push those conversations about sanctuary spaces. And anything can be a sanctuary, right? Like your home is a sanctuary. It's just mean being able to organize to make sure that it's effective. Because again, like I said, like they don't care anymore about not going inside of a church like we used to see before, when a mom and her son would hide in a church and not get targeted. So really, yeah, we need to rethink what it means to be a sanctuary space and organize to make it a reality.
Yeah, and so I haven't personally heard stories of ICE going into schools and into churches, but they will be right outside. And they do go into court. Court is not a sanctuary space in the memo. and they come into court and they wait outside of court, or they come to your home. And when you think about it, like, what's more of a sanctuary than your home? And the Constitution even says so. And that's where they're, and that's where they're coming to get people. And then just to touch also on the bed quota issue, just to make clear for people who aren't working in the field or as in touch with immigration detention or deportation, these are prisons, they're jails. Like, we say detention center because that's the term that we use in the immigration world, but don't be fooled, like, these are jails. And oftentimes they are literally jails. They're contracted local jail facilities, and sometimes run by private prison corporations, often run by private prison corporations, not directly by the federal government. There's actually far fewer federally run detention facilities than there are local jails that house immigration detainees. So they're housed with people facing criminal charges or serving criminal sentences. And when people are brought to court for removal proceedings, they, unlike criminal defendants who get to wear street clothes or suits when they're facing trial, they are brought in jumpsuits and shackles to court, and these are civil proceedings. So just to provide like a larger context for how we criminalize our undocumented and other non-citizen community members.
You know, the mandate, the 34,000 beds is a crazy thing, because it's not an internal quota of the department. It's Congress mandated this, for ICE has to fill 34,000. I mean, it's crazy when you think about Congress saying to ICE, you have to have 34,000 beds filled, right? I mean, it's...
Is there a logic? I mean, what was the ostensible explanation for that?
So... the narrative that, when I talk about this, is that the same way that in prison, the less beds that are filled, the less money that these places get, that's the same thing that they use. So in order to keep running and to keep getting money, they need to fill this bed. So they need to get as many people as possible to fill these beds, or they're not going to get the money. And it's really as simple as that, because this is not that they are going for the criminals that are filling it, it's everybody that's going in here. And so that's what we need to think about, because there's no logic to this other than money. It's all money, it's all private corporations that are.
And yeah, and if that's something that strikes a chord with you, the bed mandate detention watch, and maybe it should, Detention Watch Network, which is a DC-based organization, a membership organization, they have been, I think, leading the advocacy efforts to change the law on the bed mandate, and so you can Google them.
Yeah, and also the profit thing. I mean, it's true, and there's been a lot of attention on sort of private prison profiteers. And they've grown, and they're very large, and they're pretty horrific, and they actually, they're not supposed to, but they do lobby Congress all the time. They spent last year, I think, something like $10 million lobbying Congress. But that's not the only story. Part of the story is a neoliberal story, which is because ICE has all this money for detention specifically, they pay counties that have been defunded otherwise, right, that are not getting any other kind of money. They're paying counties, county jails, to house these people. So it's revenue for the county, and it's not just a narrative of private profiteers, but the way that neoliberalism has defunded kind of state supports, and so the only revenue they can get is for these kinds of things. That's how they've militarized the police. That's how they, so it's, you know, it's a very, very big, complex issue that is, you know, systemic. That's about the infrastructure, economic and material.
Are there other questions?
Yes.
Well, I have two questions. One, so the mandate to have an attorney when you're facing immigration is just New York City, right? It doesn't expand to the state.
Right. So yes and no. So the majority of removal proceedings do take place in New York City. So we are representing most people who are in removal proceedings, but it is a city initiative, and it's, our funding covers representing New York City residents who are detained and in removal proceedings. But if you're in removal proceedings and detained in New York City, and even if you didn't live here, like, you have an attorney as well.
There's some effort to expand it further outside of New York City, or is it, yeah, does it not matter because of what you're saying?
No, there is, and the main facilities that are outside of New York City and still within the state are actually housed, for people who are put in removal proceedings while serving a criminal sentence. Right. And there is sort of a pilot project upstate that's run out of, what are they called? Prisoners Legal Services, upstate, and they're basically running a similar program out of Ulster. And those detention facilities are like, you know, New York is a huge state, so the people, the attorneys drive like 5 hours and go meet with people and represent them.
And then I know that McGarrett is supporting the Liberty Act that's like has passed the Assembly but not the Senate, and Cuomo has vaguely said that he supports our sanctuary city. I wonder, you know, it seems like that legislation is reinforcing that we are not going to allow ICE to have coordination with our police and so forth. I wonder, you know, like you're saying, like, we currently fund this legal system, we currently don't coordinate. I'm wondering, like, how, like, first of all, in your understanding of the Liberty Act, how much does that codify keeping these things in place? And, you know, how likely is even that to secure what is necessary?
The only reason why Cuomo has really gone out to talk about passing things like the Liberty Act and passing pro-immigrant legislation is because he wants to be president. And so the only reason that he's now all supportive for immigrants is that. And that's just to start being real. The reason we've never been able to pass the New York Dream Act that would allow undocumented students access to financial aid is because Cuomo has never gone out and pushed for it, right? Because he doesn't care about immigrants, he only cares about a seat in the White House. And so yes, the Liberty Act is supposed to stop that collaboration between ICE and local law enforcement, but there's these other systems that exist, right? And unfortunately, there's no legislation that will ever pass in Albany that will stop that. And I think that we are encouraging for New York State to stand up and to be able to support the immigrant community, but we're never going to be able to get rid of prisons or get rid of police in our communities. Like, those are not things that are going to happen because the state is not going to allow for it to happen, because it would take so much organizing and power that currently does not exist. So I think that Make the Road is continuing to push for this legislation because we've seen it work. So for example, we were able to get ICE out of Rikers. So ICE used to have a little like office in Rikers where when people were being arrested, they would be sent over to ICE, and then they would start deportation proceedings against them. We helped pass something that allowed for that to stop. So that was powerful, and we saw now that not as many people are being detained as a result of that. That was important. That help keep our community safe. And so same thing that we want to do with the Liberty Act, but the reality is that there's other insidious things that surround New York State and policing and immigration that are going to be very hard to get rid of unless we like dismantle capitalism, right? So just to be honest, like I don't like romanticizing like things like, yes, we're going to save all immigrants, because that's just not the reality. I think our job is to keep as many of our people safe right now during this administration and being real about the things. And for many years, we've not been able to pass progressive legislation in Albany because of the Senate that was mostly Republican and because Cuomo would not stand up for anything. But now he's changing. He wants to be president, so we'll see what happens.
Just to clarify, the Senate is not Republican. It's because of the IDC group and Felder. Yeah. And there's a lot of activity to confront them.
Yeah, so the IDC is like the independent piece that exists, but they mostly vote Republican, and before, yeah, the Senate was mostly Republican.
I guess it's not really a question, but going to like inaction in the Senate, I think what's really interesting about what a lot of activists have been focusing on is this isn't really a Republican versus Democrat issue, because all the issues that are being discussed tonight, like broken windows, that's brought us by a Democratic mayor, endorsed by a Democratic city council. Of course, all of these enforcement priorities, which prioritize criminal by Democratic president. So even if, you know, Albany was to stand up, or even if de Blasio was to do things that actually backed up a lot of his rhetoric, you know, I just don't see that necessarily happening, because Democrats have had control in the state for so long and in the city for so long. So I guess a lot of it has to do with, like, what everyone on the stage is doing, which is like moving the conversation to a place where the truth becomes so evident that people in both parties can't just use this as a way to batter each other, but actually have to address the issues. So it's not a question, but a lot of you guys are doing
that. Just to add something to that, yes, so people right now are being used as bargaining chips to see, like, who gets more power. And yeah, it's an issue about are people that are being affected and not, like, these politicians that will reach out to national immigrant organizations and say, like, hey, you can have someone show up to Congress because we care about immigrants, but still, like, go out and target our people because they just really want to tokenize immigrants to see, yes, I support you, here's a bill that will help you, and never pass that bill and only have it be symbolic, as we saw. There's a bill that was just introduced called by Curbelo, who's like a Republican, that gave an 11-year path to citizenship. So if you want to have access to ever adjusting your status, you have to wait 11 years. That's like, that's not realistic, that's torturous, but this is like them coming out and saying they care about the immigrant community. So obviously they're just like using immigrants to push their own agenda.
I wonder what you all think action-based methods that have come up recently, like the ACLU people power thing. That are you guys all familiar with that?
Yeah. Do you want to just describe what it is?
So they, ACLU started a project called People Power, wherein they had a live stream presentation and instructed and had people organize meetings in their homes so that you could listen to this live stream together and then be instructed to take some action, which was to organize a meeting with your local police precinct and urge them to separate themselves from the presidential mandates. So, you know, like, each person at the meeting would say, like, I live in this zip code, this is my precinct, I'll call them and I'll set up this meeting. And then everybody is supposed to attend and present some force. And I've heard criticism of that based on the idea that ACLU could have partnered with another organization, specifically one run by people of color, women of color, to join up rather than creating a whole new thing. I also know of the Sanctuary Homes project by Hand in Hand, which is just another another example of something that's working with the sanctuary idea. I'm wondering if you guys have thoughts on those, or if you have other organizations that you know of that are taking specific actions or organizing people to do actions.
When you say specific actions, like anything?
Yeah.
Anything to
connect. What you would think is effective.
So I actually have not heard about what ACLU is doing. But there is, again, there's so many organizations. Like, ACLU has been getting a lot of press right now because like celebrities are doing concerts and things like that. But there's a lot of like grassroots organizations that are doing like powerful work. For example, in Arizona, there was a case of Guadalupe Lupita, who was a mother that was going to be deported. And so folks in Arizona, one of them, like Maria Castro, who's a dope, badass, like femme organizer, they sat in front of the van and like her children were also there. And you could see like the mom looking outside of the van with her children. Like those are powerful actions that are very direct. And that's dope work. I think there's so many grassroots orgs that are doing work that deserve to get money and support and resources. And like these really big organizations are getting a lot of visibility, which is good. Like ACLU does dope work. But I do think that we need to also support other organizations that are like maybe not getting as much press and support. So yeah, those are like really good actions. There is United with Dream is also a very big organization, but they also are in DC helping like push legislation, so that's good. And yeah, if I think of more orgs that are doing really good work, I definitely want to share it, but yeah.
Can you tell us how we in this room can help support Make the Road, for instance?
Well, Make the Road is a really big organization, and what we're asking especially is for folks to come out to the streets with us, right? Like when we're having actions like the one that we helped organize at Trump Tower, where 15,000 people came out in the span of 3 days, right? Like you have like the photos of this, like that's beautiful, right? To see like New York and like passing the Trump Tower and everyone being like fuck Trump, like that's powerful, right? So I definitely do want folks to come out and join us in the streets. Definitely, if you have access to folks that do funding, like, you know, helping us with funding, because that's, you know, like the revolution will be funded. Like folks need money to continue organizing. Like I'm a full-time student and a full-time organizer, and it's, you know, it's hard doing this work. Also, while like this presidency is basically like the antithesis of like what I am and trying to attack all of my identities. Yeah, and also asking like really of like white allies to step up and really like show out for communities of color, because we are continuously being killed and we know that there's targets in our backs. And you know, I think it's really important for white allies to like be helping in that sense of support. That's how I would ask folks to help Make the Road. And if you want to know your rights training for any of the spaces that you are in, or you just want to learn them yourselves, to let me know and I can come and do one for you or give you the tools necessary, because just spreading the information is already doing dope work.
Yeah, I would just add that the Immigrant Defense Project does a lot of great work, and they actually run a Train the Trainers program. They have a lot of great materials. If you are in a community that's affected, if you're part of a community that's affected and you want to learn how to do a Know Your Rights presentation to share with your community, they have really great resources for that, so you can just look them up. And yeah, in terms of being an ally, if you aren't part of a community that you think needs to have fear dispelled or know what to do if ICE comes to their door or anything else that we've talked about today, these grassroots organizations need money. And that's just always, and I know it sort of feels like a throwaway thing that you can do, but everywhere is understaffed. And like, if you can provide financial support even, to allow more people from that same community to participate, then that's always helpful too.
Yeah, a couple. I think the allies thing is really important. Citizens, white folks have to step up, take risks, push their institutions, not step back. This is not the time to step back. So all of that stuff, definitely. I mean, when we talk about, we say deportation, but it's really essentially, it's like millions of black and brown folks being disappeared, right? I mean, it's really that. So that's one thing. Then another thing is, I think, you know, a lot of groups like ACLU do. That was an interesting thing, the People Power one. I actually joined one of the groups in my neighborhood. And I mean, I have my problems with it, because essentially they're doing sanctuary stuff but not calling it that. So for me, it's a move away from a term that should be embraced and defended. So I have my own, but But aside from that, it was very unilateral. All these other organizations were left out who are already doing the work on the ground. And there's a lot of them. I mean, there's also like Baji and Damayan in New York. I mean, there's a number of, you know, really good organizing activist kind of work that's being done, that's intersectional, that's that needs also support. And the support, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that ACLU and other organizations do is all this Know Your Rights. And at this point, like with the anecdote that you gave, Know Your Rights, you might know your rights, but it's not going to serve you at that point. You need different kinds of training. You kind of need guerrilla training to survive this one. You know, you need to practice the stuff, and you need to evade the stuff. You need to go beyond knowing your rights, and we have to figure out what that really means. What spaces there are to go beyond the rights. What kind of training you need to, you know, when ICE is breaking the law and lying to you and saying, you know, I know about your children and it's trying to get in, how do you withstand that kind of assault? Those are, you know, psychological trainings. They're more than knowing your rights. So, yeah.
I'm just curious, you know, we started by talking about de Blasio and broken windows policing. I'm wondering what kind of work is being done to push him and his administration to definitively reject broken windows policing, and for instance, if like upcoming protests in May might be oriented around that issue and de Blasio specifically, rather than pressuring the federal government and Trump, or if like what kind of interactions your organizations have had with de Blasio's administration, if any, recently, based on these you know, incredibly conspicuous problems, which so many people in New York have been demanding that he, you know, that demanding that they be changed immediately for years.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not the best person to be speaking on this, but we at our organization are constantly pushing back in terms of our representation through the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project, which is the program that represents people in removal proceedings, and just really by sharing our clients' stories. And it's sort of like a public shaming of the mayor, and needs to continue. And I know that there's been also a lot of great reporting on broken windows policing that's been happening as well, and it just puts continued pressure on this administration to really step up. And if he's going to say that this is a sanctuary city, then get behind that and take that all the way. But in terms of like concrete lobbying efforts, that's sort of outside of what I know that's happening. Yeah.
The sense that it's having an effect, and it's been so long since the Blasio made the statement that Sarah started with. But I'm just curious how, what your sense is.
I mean, he also at one point had basically threatened to limit our funding to represent people, to exclude people who have certain criminal convictions. So I don't know how much of an effect it's having, and thankfully he's backed off of that. But it's just a reminder that like the pressure needs to stay on, and it needs to stay constant, because if we back down for a minute, then there's other people that have their own interests that are going to get his ear. And I don't know that it's his like natural tendency to want to shut down broken windows. So we need to show him why this is necessary for our communities.
The answer is that, I mean, I think that de Blasio is never going to go against broken windows policy, because that gives money, right? Like, it's again about money. And also because the police force does not respect de Blasio. They hate him. There was the whole thing when they like gave their backs to him when he was speaking, like they're not gonna cooperate with him. The governor and him also have like this whole tension thing. So there's definitely like, there's not gonna be an end to this. It's something that's so embedded in the system and the way that New York City and New York State runs, that it's not something that's gonna end in reality. I think though it's important to push and to highlight and bring this into the conversation, because it's not something that will ever go away. So speaking about it, showing like the horrors of it and all the correlations, like school to prison pipeline, right? Like why are students still don't have access to textbooks, right? And like why are charter schools like a thing? So all these things are correlated, and it's important to highlight them. But in my personal opinion, I don't think that de Blasio will ever move away from broken windows. I think he will say that, yeah, like people should not be criminalized, but we have not seen, we've been fighting against this since the organization started like in 99, and it's still here, so yeah. This is really important. So you mentioned about like guerrilla training. I do want to talk about civil disobedience and direct action as being important and a key component to organizing. And I'll do it really briefly. So civil disobedience is really powerful because I think putting your body on the line, if you're able to and if you feel safe to, is a way to show that you're willing to give up your freedom to for a cause. So I always advocate for that if you feel safe to and if it makes sense. And also direct action. So doing like banner drops and things like that are really powerful. And it's what gets people going, because if they're like, yo, like that's happening, they're going to want to join, they're going to want to be part of it. As long as you do it in a way that's tactful and making sure it has an impact. So I definitely think that folks should do that. And also political education is so important. Folks are not going to want to go out into the streets if they don't understand that there's a system that's continuously oppressing them, right? Like folks are not going to want to dismantle capitalism if they don't know what it is. So like being able to have those conversations with our people, but also making it accessible, because those terms of capitalism and like white supremacy are not things that maybe the person that is working selling food in the street knows about, right? They only care about like their survival and being able to provide for themselves. So being accessible to our people and using language that they feel comfortable with, and like using a lot of like the Zapatismo movement and things like that, I feel like are powerful, because we have to be accessible and know that we're privileged by even being able to be in the space and have these conversations, and that many of our people that are being targeted are not in these spaces. So political education is important to me, and also civil disobedience and things like that are valid, but we know we live in a surveilling state, so also being safe, and yeah.
For those who do want to, I mean, New Sanctuary Coalition, like other organizations, do need volunteers all the time. We do things like accompany people to Federal Immigration Plaza when they're going in without representation or without other people who, with whom they can feel okay going. So there's stuff like that. You just have to get in touch with the groups and see what you're willing to do and what you can do. Information's out there, and you know, forums like this are great to get exposed, but some of the work has to be done, you know, also by you, I guess. Including the civil disobedience. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That was really informative and very interesting. So, and thanks everyone for participating and coming.
Thanks for having us.